In this episode, we're going to be talking about Summer with Monica, which was directed by Ingmar Bergman. This is a film he actually didn't write. It was written by Per Anders Fogelstrom, and it starred Harriet Anderson and Lars Ekberg. Welcome to Robert Bellissimo at the Movies. This is a YouTube channel where I explore the many different ways that stories are told on film from all over the world. I want to welcome back my guest, David Berland, who is a YouTuber. His channel is called Cinema Dave Media. Dave, welcome back.
Robert, it's so good to talk with you again. One of my favorite films, one of my favorite topics. So,
no, thank you. I'm excited. I'm so glad, you know, because we had a great chat with Hour of the Wolf. Lastly, so it's great to meet people who are, you know, enthusiastic about Bergman, because his films, there's so much to talk about within each film. I really like this film. I think it has more of a simplicity to it, mainly because we're talking about people who are like late teenagers. But I think it's a wonderful film. This was my second viewing the other night, watching it again to refresh myself for the day. So I'm curious, how many times have you seen it, and have your feelings evolved or changed about it over time?
So coincidentally, this is my second viewing as well, which is good. I wanted to say something too about Bergman, because you and I talked about this a little bit briefly, but anytime I see a Bergman film, I feel like I want to rewatch all the films again.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And so this is absolutely the case, I think, with this particular movie, Summer with Monica. And I don't know about you, but when I turn on a Bergman film, I'm completely drawn into it for some reason.
Yeah.
And it's hard to explain. I was really trying to think about this when I was watching this yesterday, and I'm not exactly sure why. I was thinking about the beginning shots of the film. You know, usually when a director wants to present some kind of a landscape or some kind of a scene, I don't know if you noticed this before, but it seems like a common technique where they'll show like an exterior, you know, a house, and then you're inside the house, right? 3, 2, 1, and you're in.
Yeah.
You know, Bergman at the beginning of this film, and I think he does it in a lot of his films, lots of scenes of water, and it's more than three.
He does a lot of those establishing shots. And I noticed, because the last film that I rewatched of his, which I reviewed, Cries and Whispers, he did the same thing. There's all the scenes outside of the mansion, all these exterior shots, and I'm not sure why he does that, but it sort of brings you in. And I think he just doesn't like to necessarily cut to the chase of a moment. He kind of just brings you into that world, and I agree, he does really grab you, and it's hard to articulate why that is.
Yeah, you know? I was thinking, you know, the other thing too, anytime, at least for me anyway, when I watch a Bergman film, I'm always taking new things from it. But I feel like this is something that Kiarostami does also, which is he kind of gets you in the mood for the movie and kind of almost hypnotizes you for the story in a way.
Yeah.
And I feel like that sort of happens with me. If I see kind of nature scenes, or at least, you know, many more establishing shots than maybe you're used to, maybe on network television, let's say, it kind of gets you in the mood for the movie, right? It kind of sets you up for it in sort of a hypnotic, kind of mesmerizing way. At least that's the way I feel about it anyway.
So when you saw it again recently, did you have a different experience than the first time around, or quite similar?
You know, I think I did, because I feel like Summer with Monica, I know it was advertised very differently in the U.S., but it has a tremendous amount of layers to it, I feel like. And it's not just the cinematography, and it's not just the script or the characterizations. I think it's got many of the things we talked about with Hour of the Wolf, too. I was just looking at my notes here to say, even in the opening scenes, I felt like the composition of the shots were very interesting.
Yeah.
Very, very representative of the characters. And also, you get this contrast in the beginning of the serene, the water scenes, and then you get the city, right? So as the credits are rolling, right, you're getting all these images of the city. And so very quickly you understand this direct contrast between this serene sort of country life versus the loud city and the darkness of the city. And so that's something I took away from the beginning of the film. I was really kind of struck by that, which I don't think on the first viewing, I don't think I really caught on to too many of these elements. I was more interested maybe in the characters and the story, but the more you watch these films, I think you get more of a sense of that, you know, the technique there.
Yeah, I think there was, you know, I don't think he was saying, you know, calling it Summer of Monica simply because it was the summer. There's certainly something to do with the changing of seasons, creating a certain different mood within the characters. Like, they commented on it being spring at first. And so perhaps, you know, spring is getting warmer. And I think it was sort of a metaphor for the heat in the relationship, the passion that comes, of course, summer of love, you know, so to speak. Sure. And in the fall, that's when they begin to go back home, when all their problems are, you know, waiting for them. Is that something that you thought was what he was doing there?
Yeah, definitely. And you have to imagine in that area, right? The winters are very cold and dark, right?
Yeah,
and so, and
yeah.
I imagine even for Bergman himself, when we think of this routine that he's going through where he's filming in the summer, so filming must be a wonderful time, and then back into the theater, not that that's a bad thing, in the winter months, and then you're filming in the summertime. So summer itself, I mean, I think about this in the US, maybe in Canada too, you know, coming out of a cold winter, even in the area I'm in, because I'm in New York, it's a magical experience, right? To come out and to have warmer temperatures,
yeah,
and be able to go outside and breathe the fresh air and something like that. So if you think about I don't think I really appreciated this, you know, when I was younger, but on the East Coast, certainly, and any place that has the seasons, there's a tremendous amount of energy in the spring and the summer, right? Which I think,
right,
he's able to very easily represent that a lot of these things are happening in the summer.
I thought that was really, I never really looked at his films in terms of some of them. I mean, he certainly used metaphors, and not so much in the sense where you saw in more Hollywood conventional filmmaking where metaphors were, you know, often used as a shortcut to the emotion, but he really includes them, but having it be so, you know, emotional at the same time, which is really clever, and it really adds to the aesthetic of the film.
Yeah, I mean, I think I noticed these things more than I did on the first viewing, but something like a bridge, I felt like the bridges in the movie were sort of portals into these other areas, right? Because when that boat goes in, you know, under the bridge,
yeah,
and they go to these other areas that are more remote, there's sort of a magic to that. And then when they come back, they're sort of going through this portal again to a darkness. So you're going from light
that's
to dark.
Right. Yeah, yeah, that's
going from
true.
Light to dark. And that,
yeah,
and I don't think when I first saw it, I didn't really see the bridges as maybe that significant.
Yeah.
But I really felt that on this viewing that he was using those bridges in a way that said, you're going back into the darkness now.
What did you think the heart of the story really is in this film?
I mean, there's so many dimensions to it. One thing I wanted to mention before we get into that too is because we kind of touched on it, is the significance of the long take, because I feel like there's a lot more of this in this particular film too, of these long takes where you just have the camera in one place. And I think that as a technique is particularly mesmerizing also. And it kind of sets up you thinking of your own life, right? I really am drawn to filmmakers that want you to be participants in the movie.
Me too, yeah.
And I think Bergman is one of those types of directors. And some people, like I said, it's very intense. And some people don't want to have that kind of engagement with a film. I like that experience. And so the long take allows me to kind of survey the scenery, and I'm not shifting from one thing to the next. And I think he does that so well, and it really gets you to be a participant in the movie, which I think is great. So, you know, to get back to your other question, I feel like the heart of the story, yes, it's a love story. It's a love story in some ways, but it's also at the end, you get this idea that the cycle continues, this level of dysfunction maybe continues, right? That there's a yearning in the beginning for this different kind of life, and going off maybe into the wilderness and being in love and enjoying nature and enjoying life. And then they realize very quickly that they've run out of money. They don't have food to eat. They need to be part of that industrial cycle, if you will, of life. And so maybe that particular cycle is inescapable, right? It's not it's not something you can just cross under a bridge and get away from. You've got to be potentially part of it. Yeah. Now the, you know, the other thing I pulled from it, and maybe it's the pandemic and maybe it's the way things are here in the US, but I feel like there's a lot of people leaving corporate work or corporate jobs, any job basically, and going back to nature. I think that's a good thing.
Yeah.
I think it's a good thing. I think it's a renaissance, if you will. It's a rejuvenation of life in a way. Is it sustainable? Clearly in this movie, it's not.
right?
Or it may lead to crime, or it leads to, you know, where she gets caught by these people as she's trying to steal some apples and some meat.
Yeah.
To survive. So as much as it's a love story, it's also, and I don't know if you took this also, but it's like a survival story in a way, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, no, I thought so as well. I mean, I really saw it as a rough coming of age story. And
coming of age, yeah.
I think that you really nailed it, because I thought, I wasn't sure, you know, I'm like, is this a bleak sort of film? But I don't think so, because he also, the love story is very romantic, but it's not romanticized in a more conventional Hollywood way, where the guy gets the girl and they go off into the sunset. In this case, it's, you know, young, innocent love. They fall for each other quickly and passionately, and they have this beautiful experience together. And I think those moments, the scene that, of course, what got the U.S. exhibitors interested is when, you know, she's not really, you know, you don't see her naked, but you just see her from the back and the side a little bit. But that, to me, is such a tender and romantic, yeah, and beautiful moment, where he strokes her cheek and he rubs her chest, and they look at each other. And I just thought, you know, I remember listening to Teresa Russell, who was in Bad Timing, talk about that movie, because it's about a man and a woman and exploring love. And she was saying, you know, if you can have like a couple of times in your life to like truly fall in love is like so incredible. I mean, so really is very, very rare. So I think he shows you that love, there is a real the romanticism in love is true. And she is Monica, played by Harriet Anderson, also loves movies, right? And she's going to the movies early on when they're dating. And she wonders if that's what love is, if she has these dreams and she has these fantasies. But the flip side to that coin is that, you know, is passion enough? I mean, we then see different sides to her and to him, and also their age, you know, like they met really young, they fell for each other really young, and they both come from very different backgrounds. Like he's like a lonely kid, whose mother died at 8, and his father has health issues, and his father's very quiet, so there's not much talking in his house, which he talks about. And her house is completely different. You know, she's got this father who's somewhat abusive. Like she says, that he has mixed feelings about him, and there's all these kids, and she's getting sexually harassed at work and even at home with the neighbor. But they both have this mutual feeling of hating their jobs. They're in like these deadbeat jobs, and they're looking, they also have a through line where they're both don't have great relationships with their parents. So they, of course, I mean, everyone needs to rebel. And I think everyone makes mistakes, and everyone grows up making mistakes. That's how you learn. And I think in their case, you know, they maybe make one too many mistakes, you know, I'm not saying that the fact that they had a child at 19 is necessarily so bleak, because he was happier about it than she was. I mean, he seemed to be more, because he was lonely and his mother was gone, and he has more of a nurturing quality. You know, he starts to work hard and he wants to go to night school, and she's the opposite. And she doesn't even, she leaves the aunt to take care of this child. She doesn't even wake up when the baby's crying. And at the same time, I can understand why she's reacting that way, because of the way she was brought up, and she was not from a happy household, and she's young. So it's not simple, right?
I think, yeah. I mean, I think those are some great points. I mean, I really feel like there's a bleakness, I suppose, to this version or this vision of the family. And so they, as you were saying, we see some examples of the dysfunction that happens in each of their families and their home lives in the beginning that they want to escape from, which I think maybe is a common experience. I mean, yeah. I think everyone has a story. Nothing's perfect, but I think I think many of us can identify with maybe separating or getting away from your family at a certain point in your life. And maybe that's part of life. Maybe that's part of growing. Maybe that's part of realizing who you are as a person and coming back to see that family with a different way. Mm-hmm. However, I think in this particular story, we quickly realize when they get back that they're creating the same reality that they left.
That's true. I didn't think
and
of that.
So,
yeah.
And you know, particularly at the end, we haven't really gotten into too many of the details, you know, but there's that scene at the end where Harry is in front of the mirror with the baby. And at the beginning, Monica's in front of a mirror, right? And so I thought that was pretty significant as a way to, as, you know, kind of a touchstone at the beginning or bookends for that, you know, for the beginning and the end of the film. But I feel like at the end, Harry seems to be a lot more positive than Monica because he says, you know, he wants to go back. He's got visions of, I'm going to become an engineer. I'm going to learn these things. I have this interest in this thing. So he has a certain vision. It seems like his work life is a lot better. They let him go to see the baby. Let him go early to see the baby in the hospital. He seems a little bit more positive than she does.
Yeah.
And he's willing to take the baby at the end, right? But at the end, the family is broken and she's kind of gone back out and she's having affairs and things like that, right? So, you know, so from that standpoint, it's a bit of a broken dream, if you will. They had a dream in the beginning when they went off together and it's just not becoming reality, right?
Yeah, it reminded me a lot of, or I should say, this film reminded me of Summer in Monica because it's made, you know, almost 50 years later. But I don't know if you saw Blue Valentine with Ryan Gosling and Michelle Williams.
I haven't seen that one, but yeah.
But the characters are a little older, but it starts where they're the same age, but it expands on a lot more years, and it's very. The beautiful part of the romanticized part, but then the harder parts when why people split up. And I think that's why sometimes these type of stories are hard to sum up in some kind of through line, because it's not so much that it's a slice of life, but it just unfolds and with a great deal of empathy as to the realities of relationships and perhaps why people break up. You know, it's, you know, when people hear that, oh, how did such and such get a divorce? They seem so happy. But at the end of the day, you don't really know.
You don't know
what's
the details
going on, right?
Exactly.
Behind closed door, and something that has happened to one person from a child can be affecting them in the present and changing the dynamic, particularly when kids come along. So I was really fascinated by that. I just thought, the fact that they're so young, it still touches on things that happen to people when they're 18, but even in their 30s, or 40s, because you see them have to grow up very quickly with getting a career and getting money and having this child. And I was really fascinated by that. I think a lot of people can really relate to so much in here. I just thought it was, you know.
Yeah, it's a universal story. And one of the other techniques too, I mean, you know, this is why Bergman is very complicated, because it's not a simple love story, is it? I mean, it's very, you know, it's not like they get together, they break up, you know, and then at the end they get together and it's a happy ending. It doesn't work out that way. So, but there are some, you know, there are some nice moments when they're falling in love and things like that.
Yeah, I think if anything, if there's a way to, I mean, if one had to sum it up, not that I'm saying one should, but I suppose it's like a great, it's like a lesson in love. It's like, if, you know, when people are so frustrated as to why people split up and how can this happen? I think it's a real lesson in that it's not simple. As people think. And when you live with someone, this and that, and then you're living together, you're seeing different things about each other, and either the strength of the relationship has some kind of compromise or you end up loving that person more, or it deepens or it doesn't. And in this case, who knows what could happen? I mean, she leaves, but is she going to come back? I mean, because she, it seems like she has a level of guilt about what, which her self-destructiveness, the cheating. There's that great shot where she looks right into the camera and her eyes are just vacant. That, for me, that's the one, and the background goes black, you know? So I think that she doesn't really know what she's doing. And that last scene where they, you know, they seem to be sort of comforting each other as she, you know, she breaks down and she's just so confused and overwhelmed by her life, but then it very quickly goes the other way and it gets violent, right? So I mean, you know, she leaves, but is she gonna come back? I don't know. It's a tough one.
I think it's good to go back to the other scene where Monica's looking into the camera, because I feel like that's, you know, Harriet Anderson talks about that. This film happens to be on the Criterion Channel too, if you have that.
Yes, yeah.
But she talks about that particular scene, and I think that's also a way that Bergman engages the audience, when he has a character look directly into the camera, which is kind of a, you know, Harriet Anderson talks about, you know, saying like, are you crazy looking into the camera? That's not something you do. Now, you know, these days it may be more common.
Yeah.
But I think that long take with her looking into the camera is so significant. And she even talks about seeing the movie herself and feeling that sadness that she has. She doesn't seem to be, as you were saying, she just seems to have no passion at all at that point.
Yeah, I love that, because there's nowhere to go. I mean, I know in Winter Light, he had Ingrid Thulin, like, had like a whole monologue into the camera. And even like Hour of the Wolf, we saw that with Liv Ullmann as well. Like, she's almost like a narrator of this story of her husband. Hitchcock did that to an extent. It was mainly because it was the other character's POV, but he often had characters really basically looking right into the lens, and makes you feel like they're talking right to you. You know?
Yeah, and I think we mentioned this last time. Many times when I watch a Bergman film, I feel like he's talking directly to me. It's especially when he's writing the script, because it's poetry directly to me. That's the way I feel like, you know, sometimes, and that's really engaging for an audience. Now, keep in mind, not everyone is up for this experience, right? Because it's, you know, because it's pretty intense. And so, and it's very contrary to other films you might see, or other genres as well, right? An action movie or anything like that, that may be more entertaining. These films really require a lot out of the viewer.
Oh, yeah.
And so,
A simpler one for him. Yeah. Probably because they're younger, right? So I think
that's, definitely,
you know, but not to say it is a simple film, but I think it's, you know, because they're like 19, an adult audience kind of has more of an understanding of why they're, you know, reacting as they are. But you know, you talked about the writing. Is what's interesting is I always thought he wrote this, but he didn't write this.
This is
by a novelist, Per Anders Fogelstrom, and it was there's a book as well. So I didn't know that. Just watching that little interview with him on the Criterion Channel when he's watching all the movies with that journalist, he mentioned talking to this journalist, and he was telling him the story, and then he asked him, "Can you turn that into a script?" But it feels like so much like something he would write, you know? So.
Yeah. I mean, it's not as I was noticing that too, but it's not as poetic, right? It doesn't have as many of those poetic lines in the movie that I would, you know, would have assumed, but you know, just a little side note here too. I love those little, you know, if you get the Criterion disc, right, there's, you know, supplements with him, you know, with these interviews. And I'm so fascinated by his little theater that he has on the island where he, you know, retired,
you know,
where he would go to and so, and there's always a little intro with him driving up and kind of knocking on the theater door, and he's always like putting his hand up, you know, he puts his hand up to do the thing, like, I just love all that stuff.
So,
you know, being
a
Bergman fan, and just it's entertaining to watch him talk about his life, talk about his routine, talk about a lot of different things that are really influential, you know, on these, you know, these films. So, you know, it's very entertaining. If you have that, if you have the Criterion Channel, or if you have the, you know, the physical media, it's great to watch those, I think.
Yeah, I agree. I love all those. I love all those interviews and featurettes. And, you know, you also see a lot of the behind the scenes footage. And, you know, for as heavy as these films are, they seem to be having a ball. Like, I don't know if you watched that other one that came out 12 years ago, and they show behind the scenes of this film and other, and you see Harriet Anderson
just laughing. Yeah. Laughing.
Sometimes, like, you know, like Harriet Anderson, there's one point, not on this film, and another one where she's laughing so hard that like, I don't know if it was the makeup person came just to wipe the tears away. And And Bergman even said that, like, his life is chaotic, but when he's on set or doing a play, that sense of community is where he feels at home, because he certainly had a real, like, joy about him in those videos. And you know, he was a complex guy, so, and had a lot of affairs with his leading ladies, as we were saying before we started, including Harriet Anderson on this. Yeah. And when I was talking to this gentleman, Ron Getz, who I mentioned worked with Bergman, and we talked about that as well. And it's fascinating to me how often he would, these women who were like his ex-lovers or ex-wives or even his kids and you know, stuff like that, they're all in his movies, you know. And I gotta understand family in your movies, but, you know, an ex-lover, it's really interesting. But I imagine that they had a deep connection, both, you know, creatively and falling in love outside, with each other, that I think the creativity, the connection was so strong that, you know, B.B. Anderson, Liv Ullmann, and Harriet Anderson, they were able to work with him, because, you know, he was just, as they said, he was incredible to work with. So, and obviously that it speaks volumes, because their performances are, like, you know, some of the best you'll see in film history, in my opinion.
Yeah. And as you know, also from working in the film and you know, theater, right? You know, sometimes I can remember doing Chekhov plays too, and it's very serious, right? And so, but, you know, the actors, you have to kind of keep it light, you know, outside of that, because it's so very serious. And so I can see where, you know, it's entertaining and satisfying to be able to do what you love to do and really have a good time at it, even though maybe the material is very serious and you're trying to get a certain result on screen or on the stage, right? So I can see how, you know, they talk about, you know, musicians that write depressing music a lot of times. They're very happy people because you're getting all that stuff out.
Yeah, exactly.
And so I feel like that's the same with this particular process, right? You're working on a piece of art, but on the side, you can still be enjoying what you're doing. It doesn't mean that you have to be as depressed as the characters are, right?
No, not at all. And it's all, you know, I mean, they're playing at the end of the day. And Bergman even said that, like, he feels when he's on set or doing a play, it's no different than when he was a kid grabbing his toys, you know. Even though you're telling a story that may be serious or dramatic, it's always from a point of view of playing. So it's great to see that in that footage, that people are having such a joyous occasion. I wanted to touch on the U.S. release, because this is, like, it's interesting that the U.S., they first of all, they changed the title to Monica, the Story of a Bad Girl, right? And they sort of played up the sexuality, and they even recut it to an extent to make it look like it was some kind of sexy film, which, you know, in the 1950s, you couldn't, you know, for, even though you don't see Harriet Anderson completely naked, you just see, you know, partial nudity, and it's pretty brief, you know, for by today's standards, it's, you know, nothing. But at that time, you know, you couldn't show that at all. So a lot of these exploitation, you know, as they called it, exhibitors noticed that, obviously in Europe, those kind of films were fine and doing quite well, and no one, you know, batted an eye or thought it was controversial. But so they brought it over to the States. But it's just so funny to look at, like, the artwork for it and the titles, and you're like, that's not what it's about.
It's not even about that at all. Exactly. Right. Exactly. Yeah.
And, but they did well, apparently. Like, this was, like, his most widely seen film in the US and drive-ins. And I'm surprised people weren't like, what the hell, like, expecting some kind of, like, sex film or like raunchy film. And I'm surprised there wasn't, like, people wanting their money back if that's what they were expecting, because, or maybe they just thought, oh, this is actually really good. I don't know, because it is. It is not the way they promoted it at all.
Right.
You know?
Right. And again, it's hard, you know, as we know from seeing the movie, it could be a hard watch for people, right? I mean, it's a very, so maybe that's a way to just get people to the theater, you know, get people to go to the, you know, see the movie.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think so, but, I love it. And, I had a different viewing, somewhat different viewing this time around. And, at the same time, the first time I saw it, I felt that they were more victims. And this time around, I didn't see it as much that way. I thought, you know, I don't see them so much as a victim of where they're from, and so this is how they've wound up. I think it's just the gradual nature of the ups and downs and the roller coasters of you know, life and love.
Right.
You know, so it's a wonderful, wonderful film.
The other thing I want to mention in terms of technique is I feel like, especially when they get back after going to the bridge and, you know, getting back to the apartment, is Bergman will often obstruct your view in some way too. So especially when you're in the city, he's putting something in front of the camera. I don't know if you noticed that too, but like as an example, when they're in the apartment, Monica's sitting on the bed and he's shooting, it's a shot kind of through the bars on the bed, right? And
yeah,
so you're like,
yeah.
You look, you know, you have sort of this obstructed view. Whereas in the scenes with the, you know, the island and sort of where they go, it's all very open space.
Right.
When you get back to this very industrial feel. Now, the other thing I noticed that makes it
gives you the feeling of trapped, right? With the bars.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you sort of get that a little bit when Monica's on the island and she's kind of in the grass. And that's where you get this sense of a survival story, right? Where she's trying to get back to the boat. And there's shots of her in the grass, sort of looking through the grass, and you think like, this is crazy. She's become sort of an animal in a way, trying to, you know, bring this meat back to the boat and stuff like that. The contrast between following your dreams and doing what you want to do and being fulfilled there, right? Sometimes it's not possible depending on what happens. And I think, you know I said this before too, but I feel like Harry anyway, he seems much more hopeful to me because of his aspirations as, you know, being an engineer. And he's actually left a workplace that was oppressive and abusive. And he's gone into a place where they seem to accept him. Yeah. He seems to be on a good path there. Monica, you know, not so much near the end, but I feel like, you know, it's possible, right? It's possible to work in, you know, in a system where you can both have your dreams somewhat fulfilled and still earn money and still work and, you know,
because he certainly had more of a plan, you know, he certainly had more of an idea, something to strive for, whereas she's much more lost and was just thinking about leaving home. So, and it's not that it's her fault, right? It's just, you know, the way it was and the way, you know, how old they were and different things like that. It's every time, you know, I see his films again, I'm always wowed and always see so much. So this was another great chat, Dave.
Absolutely.
So, yeah. Thanks so much for coming on. And where's the best place for people to find your channel or read up more about you?
Yeah, so my YouTube channel is Cinema Dave Media, and I'm also on TikTok as well, which I'm having a lot of fun with, and Instagram. And so, you can find me there. I love your channel, you know, and it's great to see everything growing there too. So I wish you all the luck. And this has been great. I really, as you know, I love his, you know, films so much, and these chats have been really great. So,
well, thanks so much. No, I appreciate that, and I feel mutually the same way. So I'd love to have you back again and to do another Bergman or anything else that may mutually interest us. So yeah, please come again.
Absolutely. Thanks so much.
Yeah, no, my pleasure. And for those of you here for the first time, I also want to mention my Patreon membership. Just go to patreon.com/RobertBellissimo@the movies, where I have bonus content, which is exclusive for members of my Patreon. And I also have an audio version of this podcast. It's on any of the platforms. And if you're heading out and just want to listen, then you can listen on any of the, you know, various platforms. And, but not everything is on the audio version. So head over to the YouTube channel when you're home to see more videos and more episodes there. And just lastly, if this is your first time here as well, please consider subscribing. It is absolutely free to do so. Again, this channel explores cinema and storytelling from all over the world. Just press the Robert Bellissimo at the Movies logo. You'll see it above, floating above my head to your top left. Just click on that and then click the bell in order to get a notification every time I release a new video or when I go live. Thanks so much, folks. We'll see you in the next video.